we're allowing the people who live in that extreme world to dictate society. This is how we're doing it. We're telling our society that we have to live according to the most extreme values, not the healthy values, not the values that we believe in, but the extreme values. That's horrible.
Hello, and welcome back to the Chochmat Nashim podcast. I'm Ann Gordon, here today with
Shoshana Keats-Jaskel.
We also have a very special guest today. Shlomo Lieberman is a licensed clinical social worker. He has been working helping people in the New York area for the past 30 years, particularly Brooklyn and Lakewood. We will hear from Shlomo Lieberman very shortly. First, of course, this happened.
Well, Anne, this week, what happened was that Shira Isakov, who you might remember from the news when, unfortunately, Erev Rosh Hashanah, her husband attempted to kill her in front of her two-year-old child. And because of the neighbors who heard her screaming for hours, they were able to finally break through and save her. She's been in the hospital for months and will need extensive rehab. Thank God she did survive. And on Tuesday, the 10th of February, she received her get from him. Now, he had been refusing to give it, but due to the intensely high public interest in this case, which probably had a tremendous influence on the judges, they actually said to him, if you do not give her the get, we will call you in every day and we will put you into solitary confinement, which is a very rare thing for the rabbinical court to threaten. But the man was already in jail for assaulting his wife. And he gave her the get. And thank God she is now free of him and she can continue to rehabilitate and to move on with her life. We wish her only the very best.
It's kind of like very good news on the heels of totally atrocious news. It's very like you can't just be happy because the happiness is coming on such a terrible base. Okay, so I want to open today with the fact that, as you know, you our listeners know, we have been talking about the impact of erasing women on women for years, meaning the impact that the phenomenon of erasing women has had on women themselves. We've talked about it all the time. Today, we're expanding that conversation. We're going to talk today about what kind of impact does the phenomenon of erasing women have on men? And if you think that the absence of women's images in publications turns men into more refined, holy tzaddikim, right? That's what's supposed to happen. Then I can tell you, or we're going to discuss today, how the data does not exactly support that conclusion. To the contrary. And so today we're talking with an expert in men's psychological and emotional well-being, and he's hailing from the Frum world as well. We are speaking very much within the world that does have publications that erase women. And the question that we are raising is, what is the impact of that on the people who have the prime exposure to this phenomenon?
I actually had a conversation. I was privileged to speak with Shlomo a couple of weeks ago in research for an article that will be coming out soon, God willing, which really led me to saying, I would love to speak with you, Shlomo, on the podcast. So first of all, welcome.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
And second of all, are you ready for all your questions?
I hope so.
So the first question is pretty easy. Could you just tell us a little bit of your background, what you do, and how you have come to be the person that we're talking to today about this issue?
Okay. So I'm a licensed clinical social worker. I graduated probably in 1990. I've been working ever since in the Brooklyn and then Lakewood communities. Most of what I do is surrounding marital therapy, relationship therapy, parenting, families, as well as the shidduch dating crisis, as they call it, and helping people through these various different aspects.
Okay. First of all, I happen to be from Lakewood. I don't know if I've mentioned that to you before, but I lived in Lakewood back when it was Lakewood. I used to say back when, before it was Brooklyn, but then people said Brooklyn got really mad at me. So now I'm just saying Lakewood when it was mixed and wonderful and I loved it. And anyway, now it's very, very different. So in your work, what have you seen the implications of erasing women in print, online, et cetera, on men or marriage, you know, the couple relationship for men who aren't exposed to women's images or even women in their lives because of the extreme segregation that has taken place, of which this erasing women is a part?
So I think it would be helpful if we broke it down a little bit, because, you know, there are so many different effects and consequences to the eraser of women, the segregation, the whole way we look at things. So I want to look at it sort of as a community, sort of a sociological look at things, if we can, a little bit, within the family and the family unit is the second way. Probably we'll spend most of the time there, as well as the individual, right?
Okay.
This week, just to give you an example off the top of my head, that I had a mother come into me this week, and she was talking about her daughter who is beginning the dating process. She went on 3 or 4 dates, and all the boys said no. And the reason the boys said no, they gave back the feedback they got, was this girl was shy. She wasn't responsive. She wasn't connecting on the dates. And the mother was shocked about this, because this is an outgoing girl. This is a girl who's friendly. This is a girl who has friends. She couldn't understand the problem. And the girl kept saying, I don't know. I don't know. I just don't feel comfortable. I just don't feel comfortable. Finally, after meeting a dating coach, she came back to her mother and she said, I figured out what the problem is. What was the problem? She's sitting with boys who aren't looking at her in the face. They aren't giving her eye contact. They're all looking a little past her, because the boys are being taught not to look at girls. So this girl is actually being asked to make contact to somebody who's not even able to lift their face and look at her in the face. So wow. I just thought that was such a perfect example of what it is we're talking about, what it is we're doing in this process. Because how in the world is a young man and a young woman supposed to get together and create a relationship, the most important relationship in their whole life, when they can't even look at each other in the face? Doesn't make sense.
Right.
So let's break this down a little bit. On a societal point of view, when we create a situation, we create an environment where there are suit sales and clothes sales, and there's a picture of a man dressed in a suit next to a mannequin dressed in a dress. What does that say to the society who's receiving that image? It says the world that we're living in is created for men. The Torah world, everything is created for men. The men are the centerpiece of it. Women, like food, are a necessary thing that we have to deal with. Not only that, but they don't only become just a necessary thing that the men have to deal with, they become an assignment, a test. Now, this would be a lot easier to deal with if we were just dealing with sexism. If we were just dealing with men who are trying to, keep the control and keep the power, and if we were just dealing with simple sexism in a society, that would be much easier. But this is wrapped in modesty. This is wrapped in tzedakus. This is wrapped in righteousness, right? So not only are we selling it to the men that this is the way the world to be, we're selling it to the women too. Mm-hmm. They're not going to fight City Hall because their power is being taken away, but that's the right thing to do, is to be, when I was a kid, there used to be a saying that children should be seen and not heard. And all the psychologists yelled and screamed at that saying, how can you say that children be heard? It was such a horrible thing to say. But what we're telling girls in our society, we're telling girls that they should not be seen or heard, that they shouldn't even be looked at. So it creates a male-centered world. The society is a male-centered world. That's just uneven. That's not powerful. I mean, imagine for the women, for the girls to grow up in a world that the world was created for my brother. The world was created for my father. It wasn't created for me.
So my question is, I think I have a couple of questions here. There's plenty of food for thought here. I understand why that's a bad situation for the girls. I personally, of course, find this whole imbalance, impossible, I would say. But if somebody in the yeshivish world, someone in the Haredi world thinks that this is truth, right? This is, right? Somewhere it has to be coming. They have to be learning that this is the way God intends our society to be, or something like that, right? Because every aspect of everything we do is governed by Torah and halacha and so on. So the idea that this is a power play, let's say, does not sit well with me, but I'm also quite certain that that is not where the men themselves are coming from. What is the impact on them, on the men who might not think that this is a bad imbalance, because if the imbalance is Torah true, then it's just how God created the world, and then it's their right, and so divine right, whatever. I know I'm talking around a few different points here, but it's because I'm struck by, again, several different points. One being, how do the men themselves relate to this? And then what is the impact on them of this phenomenon, which they may think to be very positive?
So, like I said before, the reason why it's so dangerous is because it's wrapped in that righteousness, right? This is tzedekus. This is the way of the world. This is the way it should be. So one effect is that without intending to, it will exclude the women in their life from the major areas of their life. And that itself can break down any marriage. I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about. A few years back, I had a woman come to me, and she was coming to me because she was having a hard time dealing with all the things required of her. Life just required so much of her to take care of the kids and to have the kids and to run a household and to be working. And for her, it seemed extremely overwhelming what the normal expectations were. One of the things that came out is that her husband, who was learning at the time, would go to the Rav and ask a shaila that they had. And maybe it was the way he was asking the shaila, but he'd come back with what the ideal was. This is what the ideal is. This is what we should be doing. And I'm going to choose my word carefully. He'd inflict that on his wife. Meaning it
That's
wasn't
a strong
something.
Word.
Yes, exactly. It wasn't something that we should strive for. It was something that from yesterday to today had to be. It came clear to me that her husband was suffering from an anxiety issue. And he was inflicting his anxiety into the household, whether it be taharas hamishpacha issues, whether it be kashrus issues, whether it be chinuch issues for the kids. It was coming from a place of anxiety. And I encouraged this wife to join her husband and go meet the Rav together and talk to the Rav together about these shilas that are being asked so that she can give her perspective over. Also, the Rav can answer the shilas on both their perspectives. Now, the answer she got from her husband when she came home and asked for this was that the halacha realm of the world was the husband's job. Asking these shilas was the husband's job. This is her place. If she's going to come with him, the only reason that she's coming with him would be as if he was failing. But he's not failing. He succeeded. So why should she be coming with him to ask these shilas? That idea, that imbalance, that her experience doesn't count. And he wasn't a bad guy. He wasn't coming from a place of power and control. He was coming from a place of, this is what I have been taught. This is my role. Why am I allowing you into my role?
Do you think he would have been his own better fulfiller of mitzvot, whatever, had she been part of the conversation?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But she was sober. Not only that, the result of all this, by the way, is eventually, because of my encouragement so much, because this girl was going to have a breakdown, she went behind her husband back and she called the Rav. And the Rav himself called them both in and sat them down together. And they went over all the different shilas and what she's feeling and what his reaction when he comes home is. And it became clear to the Rav that all of his shilas were being asked from a place of anxiety. And the Rav said to him, you know, all those shilas I answered, all my answers are null and void.
Wow. Kol hakavod to that rabbi.
Yes.
Because we often hear stories that go the other direction. This is really good to know.
I thought you were coming to me because you wanted to learn the ideal, not because of anxiety. Now that I know it's anxiety, the answers have changed. But if her perspective isn't being brought in, if her experience isn't being brought in, and so many families are like this, where the wife's perspective is not what counts. She doesn't have the voice. And not again, it's not because they're evil. It's not because they're controlling, although that's out there too, right? You know, we all know that, you know, you just mentioned that case. For the most part, it's not coming from an evil place. It's coming from a place where we've learned that this is all about the men. This is the men's world. This is the men's, and the women don't have this voice. And that picture of a man in a suit next to a woman in a mannequin is what teaches men that this is the man's world.
It's so ironic because, first of all, utilizing this picture, this literal picture of a mannequin versus a human. It's number one, it's objectifying, you know, she's a doll or she's a mannequin. She's faceless. She's replaceable. One is the same as the other. The mannequins come out on assembly lines, and they certainly do not have features that are discernible, and they certainly don't have personalities, and it's interchangeable. And the notion that a human Jewish woman is simply interchangeable is so damaging. From what I've learned over the years, and I'm not a sociologist or a psychologist or social worker, but the idea that she or a woman is the same as every other woman, and that any woman should be able to do the ideal. I can just imagine the man going to the rabbi and saying, you know, what's the most ideal way to raise children? What's the most ideal time to do dinner? And what's the most ideal time to this and that? And he gets an answer about, like, you know, oh, this would be ideal. And lo and behold, here's one woman expected to hold up all of these. He's not, you know, the guy's not expected to, but she's holding up all these ideals. And it's like, you have a recipe for absolute disaster. And you see a number of couples. What do you see over and again, or maybe in an increasing fashion, regarding this type of not seeing someone as a person, an individual, someone who can carry, someone who can hear, perceive, have a relationship, that, you know, back and forth, communicate types of things?
You know, I'm glad you bring that, because that brings me to my second point of the family. What are we doing with the family? How are we dealing with the family? So the segregation is not only in pictures. The segregation has become within our family systems. A lot of families have adopted this methodology where the concept that a sister or a mother brings anything to the table except for the children is non-existent. Schools, for example, you know, when we were talking earlier this week, we talked a little bit about it. You know, schools have made it so that we've minimized the time that boys and girls are together. Brothers and sisters have had a minimal time together in a family system. Vacations are scheduled different. You know, boys, yeshivas have different times off than the girls' schools have off, so to avoid them spending time together. Dinners, the weekday family dinner has practically disappeared because the boys' yeshiva is on a different schedule than the girls get home. So mom is serving dinner in shifts to, you know, different at different times. And the idea, what's happening though, is that interaction between the boys and the girls are minimized to a point where it's almost non-existent. Now, two things happen. One is, again, the boys live a world of boys. The most intimate relationships they have are with their shtenders. There is no relationship or bonding with anybody. A female is something of a different species, totally different species. They have no experience whatsoever. Think about the training. You know, we all talk about the family unit, right? We look at shidduchim for our kids or whatever it is. The first thing we want to know is, what is their family like, right? So we all know the effect of family on somebody's psyche and somebody's growing up. We all know the effect of family on how people grow up. But the idea that the family minimizes or puts the girls in a place, so all of a sudden, that idea is transferred into a person. So let me give you a couple ideas to make this real, okay? There was a young lady, she actually came in marital therapy. She came from marital therapy with her husband, but it was clear very quickly that her self-esteem was non-existent. Right? It was below zero. And in learning about her and her family unit and what was going on, just to give you the pinpoint of this, this is what she overheard her parents having a conversation when she was 10 years old. When she was 10 years old, she was diagnosed with dyslexia. She was recommended to have tutors and to have learning specialists and to have people around her to support the learning process. She overheard a conversation between her mother and her father. Father's answer was, why are we spending so much money to educate her when in reality and in life, all she's going to need to know is how to cook a potato kugel?
And the mother said?
I don't even know what the mother said. To be honest with you, I don't even know. But ultimately, the idea being that that's the perception. You know, people ask, we all use the word self-esteem, right? What is it? How does it work? So it's very clear. From the time you are born, in the back of your head, there is a special recording. that is recording. I used to say tape recorder, but I'm aging myself when I say tape recorder. Okay.
We know.
Okay. There's a tape recorder in the back of your head that's recording a special recording. What's that recording? That recording is your perception of how other people perceive you. So it's not necessarily based so hard on reality. It's based on your experience of how other people perceive you, right? So the example I give when I teach this is, let's take a child who's born the youngest, right? Maybe even his next sibling is 5 or 6 years older than him. So everything that he does, every new thing he learns, everybody else has already learned. So due to no fault of anybody, right? Nobody did anything wrong. He perceives himself as less intelligent than everybody else around the home. That becomes a perception.
Because they already know what he is only now learning.
Correct. Right. That becomes a perception. And that can affect the self-esteem. And nobody did anything wrong, right? Now, let's superimpose our problem that we're talking about. Let's superimpose where your brothers aren't allowed to spend too much time with you, where your father sits and learns. And by the way, I see coloring books like this. It drives me crazy, right? You know, coloring books on the one picture on the first page is daddy sitting with all the sons and learning. And the next page, mommy's doing what with the girls?
Cooking, cleaning, serving.
It drives me nuts.
Hey, that's already got
crazy.
A picture.
What are we telling our girls?
That book already has a picture of right. the girls. I'm not doing so bad. The expectations are getting lower and lower.
Perceptions, my perception of my purpose, my perception of where I am is I'm something that should be not seen, not heard, put in the closet, and just like a broom brought out when something needs to be cleaned or served or put away.
Okay, but I'm going to argue with you here, Shlomo, and I'll tell you why. Because I've been told that Jewish women are diamonds and Torahs, only to be brought out on special occasions, and that there is glory in the fact that we earn our Olam Haba by serving our brothers and fathers when they learn. And I know that I am being slightly sarcastic, but the fact of the matter is, there are thousands and thousands of women, an entire culture, who believe this and internalize this. I don't want to belittle them. This is how they're taught. And there are videos, you can look at the videos for the Agudas Siyum HaShas, and the women will tell you, I don't know that gobbledygook Gemara, but I'm earning my schar, I'm earning my Olam Haba by making sure they can learn. So my question to you is, how do you say, on the one hand, if you learn that all you're meant to do is serve, it ruins your self-esteem? And on the other hand, the fact that there are people who truly feel, believe, and live the way that they do, that servitude or that, you know, solicitousness is the way they earn what they're meant to earn. That's their tafkid. That's their job.
So let's look at really scientifically where that came from. Where does that come from? Because first of all, if you look at Tanakh is that's not the picture of women that we have, by the way, right? Women in all of Tanakh were not the people who were necessarily just. I don't mean that they weren't, but they weren't just in charge of the kitchen. That's not who they were. Tanakh is replete with women who were leaders. They may have been different types of leaders than the men were, but they were leaders, mm-hmm. right? If you look at Tanakh, we are separate. Miriam got up and danced with the girls at the crossing of the Red Sea, right? Of the Yom Suf. They definitely danced separate, but they weren't hidden. They were separate. Our leadership was definitely different than the men's leadership because we have different roles. Scientifically, men and women are different. As much as our general society would love to equalize us and make us as equal as can be, the reality is that men and women are different. And science constantly proves from emotional, scientific, neurological, all of it, it's different. 100% different. But the idea that women just serve is not true. That wasn't their role. Their role was education. Their role was taking care of the family. Their role was much more, but it was side by side with their husband. The idea that they just serve is not so.
I would certainly agree with you. We can say that, I just want to change for a second, the men and women are not the same. I would say like equal but not the same would be, I prefer to say it that way simply because
right.
people like, you know, I don't want people to quote you out of context and say men and women are not equal and science proves it. Like I just, let's just make that clear. You mean the same, that we have differences.
Yes, I mean equal in value, but different in process and different in how we look at the world, different how we perceive the world, different how we interact with the world. The idea that women's relationship with the Kadosh Baruch Hu is through their husband is a horrible concept. Because first of all, what are you telling all those women who don't have a husband? Doesn't make sense.
Absolutely does not make sense.
Women have their own relationship. By the way, here's the other piece to it. Why is it that women don't count as a minyan? Why is it that they don't need to learn as much? They don't need to whatever it is. By the way, it matches up with science also. It's psychology and Torah are aligned on this 100%. The reason is because women are wired for connection. They do not need reminders about connection. About relationship. They're wired for it internally. Anybody will tell you it's easier to raise a firm girl than it is to raise a firm boy because that connection is programmed inside. The reason they don't need to go to a minyan is because they don't need that reminder. The guys need the structure. It's because we're weaker, not because we're stronger, not because we're better.
So here's the problem, right? You say we're wired for connection and men are less wired for connection. So if you add to that fact or, you know, basis, the separation of men and women, the segregation, the erasure of women, and you remove women. You told me when we spoke that people in general learn passively. So just to bring this back to the topic, because it's really important that I want to hear from you, what happens when men are not exposed to the female, to women, to girls, when any instance of seeing a female then becomes shocking and surprising and strange and sexualized, if I can be so, you know, bold as to say, when women are erased, we are sexualizing them. We're saying we can't see them. So what are these effects on men? And then men is part of a couple.
I just want to add to that.
Sure.
I know that part of the phenomenon of erasing women is that if men and women, boys and girls, cannot see images of from women and girls, that doesn't necessarily mean that they never see secular images of women and girls. And I understand that they should not be. And I'm sure that there are some segments of the religious population that do not, but that is not across the board. And what that tells me is that the education that hits the men and the boys anyway, and the women themselves, right, is coming from Hollywood. We're talking about the opposite. I can't say that nobody in Hollywood is dressed modestly, but it's not a value in the way that it is in the from world. And to say that then they're not getting the values that we want them to get makes sense to me, at least as a sweeping generalization. So my question then is, you know, how the gap between the problem of having no images of the population that you're part of and what then happens of seeing women in a much more distant way, it seems to me that all the more so perverts the absence of the women's images, not just for the women themselves, but for the men.
Right. So let's break it down twofold. Let's talk about, first of all, the idea that women have become quite literally the forbidden fruit, the thing that you're not supposed to look at. And I use the word thing, right? You know, the thing that you're not supposed to look at, you're not supposed to think about, you're not supposed to spend time with, you're supposed to avoid. Yes, you have a taiva inside, but you have to fight that taiva. And the girls are there as an asayon, you know, for you to get over and get past. So what are we doing? We are dehumanizing 50% of the population. And we are basically telling men that women are nothing more than sexual objects. Not to mention the fact that you're 100% right. What happens is when you tell somebody something is so forbidden and something is so off limits and so bad and so whatever it is, their taiva is that they go look for it. And where are they going to find it? They're not going to find the frum woman. That's not what they're going to see. They're going to go and they're going to find exactly what they learned. That women are sexual items, because yes, I think that you're right. Most people in Hollywood are not dressed neatly, right? That's not Hollywood's thing. So what they then get exposed to is just underlying that sexualized image of women, which is totally not what the Torah had in mind. at least not the way I perceive it. That's not what it is. You know, men already have a problem with connection, with emotional connection, with emotional vocabulary, with emotional, they already have that problem. Now what we're doing is giving them no experience growing up, no connection to any female growing up, no vision of it, no seeing it, no whatever it is. And now we're telling them suddenly, after they've already chosen, by the way, who they're going to marry, then they have to create this connection and relationship with this person who's a sexualized item to them. So yes, it becomes a problem. Now, I have no scientific data. I'm not going to say this, that I have scientific proof of this, but it doesn't surprise me that one of my specialties, by the way, I hate that word, but one of my specialties that I've worked with a lot is addiction. And when I first began working with addiction, I ended up with a bunch of from yeshivish, some learning in kollel, men who were sexual addicts. And I ended up with a lot more of them and more of them. And I'm not going to tell you that I have data and proof that our segregation is causing sexual addiction.
When you say sexual addiction, are you talking about pornography or are you talking about actual having sex?
I'm talking about it starts with pornography and most of it is pornography, but it doesn't stop there. A lot of them cross boundaries. Unfortunately, the world is replete with opportunity, right? So
just to be clear, it's not that they're spending a lot of time with their wives.
No, they're not spending a lot of time with their wives. Their wives don't count. Their wives are not even in part of the picture, but they're spending time on the internet. They're spending time at strip joints. They're spending time doing things that they should never do. But unfortunately, and I strongly believe that this process, that erasure, that hiding of women, that making them the forbidden fruit, makes women into a sexual object and makes women into something that is totally and completely all about that taiva. And it's not a person. It's not somebody you're talking to. It's not somebody who has their own thoughts. It's not somebody who has their own machshava. It's somebody that's simply there about earthly pleasures.
I have two questions about data. And I understand we're not going to hold you to anything as a scientific study. But the first is, do you have a sense, and I really mean just a sense, of how proportionately, percentage-wise, I guess, you know, I don't mean literally the numbers, the frum men are more or less likely to be addicted as sexual addicts as compared to any other kind of addiction or substance abuse or whatever, gambling, I don't know. That's one question, meaning within the frum world, where does this fall on the spectrum of addiction? And the second question is, how does that relate to the percentage or ratio of sexual addiction in the non-Jewish world or the non-frum world?
So, you know, if I ever wanted to make my mother happy and become a PhD, I can do a scientific study on that. But let me explain it like this. I think that there is, even if there's 1%, right? 1% is a low number. But if you think about what 1% means out of thousands and thousands of people, it's a lot of people. So one life, one person is already too many, right? So even though the numbers may not be so blown up, I'm not going to tell you 90% of men are that's not true. But right now in Lakewood, there are SA programs with literally hundreds, if not thousands. But I would imagine that it's probably about 500 to 600, 700 men who are members of these SA programs.
For the audience, I just want to say SA would be Sexaholics Anonymous.
The same thing, right. Same thing as Alcohol Anonymous. This is sex. Now, is our society, is our culture creating this more than the outside world? So the outside world has its own problems, right? It's not that the outside world doesn't create its own problems. And we're not, I don't think any of us here are saying that our from society should live life like the outside world. That's not what we're here for. That's not what we're saying. Right. So the outside world has its own problems. But does this erasure of women, does this lack of connection, does this lack of humanization of women and females create and cause and exacerbate sexual addiction? Absolutely. 100%. No doubt about it.
You know, Shlomo, I interviewed a few people for this article, the one that I interviewed you for, and one of the young men was so eloquent in his response. He's in his low 20s, And he sent me back a beautiful response. And he said, I'm 20, whatever, I'm married, and I am a porn addict. He said, and I am far from the only one. It is tragic to me, and I'm working on it. And it's, you know, I'm working on this, I'm working on my marriage, this and that. He said, but 100% the segregation, the erasure, the keeping us from women has absolutely made me like what you said, which is the forbidden fruit and thinking about it all the time. And he said, and more than that, the guilt on top of that, the guilt he feels is also right. So devastating to him, to his relationship with his, what he's trying. And I feel for young men who are put to this challenge, you know, they basically said, well, you can't help yourself, but help yourself, but we're going to make it harder for you. And I appreciated his honesty. And I can't imagine how many more, like you're saying, are feeling the same way.
Right. 100%. I would tell you that's the other piece to this. The other piece to this is what we do is when men actually get together with women, you know, they get married. And, you know, when I was engaged, I told everybody the best way to meet girls is by getting engaged, because all of a sudden your spouse introduces you to, you know, suddenly, you know, there are females everywhere. But when men suddenly have these conversations and they enjoy connecting and they find that there's another world out there, then comes also the guilt about, you know, I shouldn't be doing this. I shouldn't be connected. I shouldn't be interested. I shouldn't have. How many guys do I talk to who don't want to have guests? They literally don't want to have guests at their Shabbos table because they're afraid of the guilt that they're going to feel if they happen to, like one of the girls said, or has a conversation with her. Where, why does that have to come with guilt? Why can't that be appropriate? We're taking away normal. There's no such thing as normal anymore. That's a problem.
That's very interesting. Yeah, there's no normal anymore. That is pretty much how I've been feeling for a few years now, because I've just seen it getting worse, and it's certainly getting worse here, and it's getting worse in the States.
It's unbelievable. You know, it's funny, because for me, whoever I talk to, and maybe my view is definitely slanted, because I'm coming in contact with people who are suffering from the consequences of all of this, right? Everybody I talk to agrees. Nobody I've talked to said, no, we need to keep the segregation. We need to keep it the way it is. This is the right way. Nobody that I've ever talked to, even with Rebbeim, by the way, I've talked to Rebbeim about this. And nobody has ever said, no, this is the way it should be. Not one person has said that.
Wow. To me.
But the answer I get when I discuss the things is, this is the way it is. We can't fight it. We can't fight it. And what we're doing is we're allowing the extremists, we're allowing the people who live in that extreme world to dictate society. This is how we're doing it. We're telling our society that we have to live according to the most extreme values, not the healthy values, not the values that we believe in, but the extreme values. That's horrible.
What you're saying leads me to say, if the Rebbeim will not stand up and try to reshuffle this into a more, as you describe it, more normal kind of frum, what is left for us to do? Treating the people who are already in a bad way is a very noble calling. But what about the rest of us? What can we do to, I don't know, meaning how can we help this, prevent it, make sure that the next generation doesn't suffer the foibles of this situation?
So as much as everybody can say, you know, I can't fight City Hall, and I don't want to fight the way it is, and I don't want to, not everybody is as brave as you guys to get behind and chant for what's right. But this is what I do challenge my clients with. We can design our families. We can design our households. We can design the way we live our lifestyles to be what we think is right. We don't have to design our family lifestyles according to what everybody else, the extreme values that we don't participate in. So it goes from the smallest decisions to what magazines we bring into the house to do we have dinner and who we have dinner with and what are the discussions and what are the discussions like. One mother that, you know, has sort of a wide range of children that I was working with, and when her older children went into the shidduch world, that's when the consequences of the segregation sort of hit her, because she realized how little her children really knew how to manage this and how to create a relationship. And, you know, she started thinking about, you know, what she's doing at home different and what she can do differently. So one of the things she did, a small thing, but it's so meaningful. I think it's so important. She began to make sure that siblings picked out birthday presents for siblings.
Wow.
That means a brother is going out and has to pick out and buy a birthday present for his sister.
So nice.
The idea that she becomes a person. I have to think about what her likes are. I have to think about what her desires are. But those are the types of things she brought into her home. Inequality. It wasn't just about running off to yeshiva. It was bringing back into the house and connecting with the children and the children connecting with each other and talking to each other. You know, sibling rivalry has a very important purpose. How do men and women learn how to argue? They learn how to argue because, I don't know about you, I have three older sisters. And the reason that, you know, I am today planning my 30th anniversary is because my three older sisters beat the living hell out of me, you know, until I got it right. Right? I thank them because they trained me. But if we don't have that, if we don't have that connection, if we don't create that connection, and we're never mind not creating connection, we're running away from that connection. So we're just allowing extremism to create our family values. And we do have the ability to dictate how we lead our family. We do have the ability to design the values in our home. That we do have the ability to do.
That is such a strong, I'm like sitting here and I have like chills, something so simple, but it teaches so much. Think about the other person. Think about how they're going to feel, what they like, and how they're going to feel when you give it to them, and expect that feeling and connection. It's so simple. And what I really like about that is that, you know, it's hard for people to buck the system and to feel like they're doing something different, but this is something people can do in their homes without having to buck that system, without other people having to know, you know, how they're doing it, not in a way that is in your face. I love that, Shlomo. I would love, actually, afterwards, I want to talk to you about like more things that people can take into their homes and how they can work on this. Because I think everyone asks us this all the time, what can I do? And I love to be able to answer that question. So you're going to have to hear more from me.
There's a philosophical shift that we can make in how we raise our children, okay, and what we do. We talk about all the time, and I hate the wording. It just drives, gives me, every time we talk about it, we talk to our children from the day they're born about what they do and how it affects getting a good shidduch. Life is about getting a good shidduch. It's about how people are going to perceive us and what we're going to get in return. And the philosophical shift that I would love for families to make, and this can make a huge difference. Instead of talking about how to get a good shidduch, let's talk about how to be a good shidduch. Let's spend
that is a beautiful formulation.
On what does it mean to be a good shidduch? Because if our focus was on what it meant to be a good shidduch and what it meant to be there for somebody else, so then we can't erase women because that becomes the focus. The focus is for men, how do I become a good husband for females, for women? So that becomes the focus. If the focus is how do I get a good shidduch, then it's all about what I have to do and how I have to be perceived.
That is a really important shift in thinking. I think it is very welcome. And now the question is, how do we disseminate this across the entire from world rapidly? Because I think it would change society so easily, meaning not easily, but it would be such an easy switch if people could take it on. I think that right. This is, Sean, I think this is something that we need to now promote beyond just this podcast, because I think that as a value, it's everything that we're about. And it is such a subtle and careful way of, you know, making the change in society that we keep talking about. And it's without fighting, honestly, right? It's about shifting perception, and then facts on the ground will be different. It's everything we want.
I love it. Fantastic. Oh, there's so much to do. And we have a lot of work to do.
We have a lot of work to do. In fact, I think we must wrap up now and get to it. Thank you, Shlomo, for joining us. Thank you for sharing your insight and your experience and your wisdom with us and with our listeners. We really appreciate it. To all of our listeners, come tell us what you think on the Chochmat Nashim Facebook page, via Instagram, via email. You know how to reach us. You know the address, C-H-O-C-H-M-A-T-N-A-S-H-I-M.
Well done. Can you hear us now?